suspension of civil liberties, selective detention of citizens without due process. It sounds like an Orwellian nightmare, the kind of thing that could never happen in this country, but it already did in Hawaii during the Second World War years when martial law was in effect. Harry N. Scheiber is the author, with Jane Scheiber, of Bayonets in Paradise, Martial Law in Hawaii During World War II, a study based on archival material of an unprecedented chapter in Hawaii and U.S. history. He's on the line with us now. Good morning, Harry.
Morning, Chris.
This was an episode that is little understood, would you say?
Well, it's little known, despite its tremendous importance as part of the American U.S. constitutional history and heritage, and to say nothing of its huge importance in Hawaii. The standard U.S. history textbooks that are used in colleges and high schools don't even mention it. Even in the textbooks used and casebooks used in the law schools of America, it's almost forgotten and almost universally neglected. So one of our objectives in taking on this huge project, which my wife and I worked on for over 20 years, was to bring this episode in American history to light.
Americans live in a pretty comfortable bubble of, this could never happen to me, this could never happen here, yeah?
Well, there is that bubble. Of course, it was the one thing that does get attention, not only on the West Coast in Hawaii, but in American history text generally, is the incarceration of the Japanese Americans on the West Coast.
Yes.
Of the mainland. And that was a nightmare for them, of course. But what distinguished that from the Hawaii situation was that although there was consideration by President Roosevelt and George Marshall, the Chief of Staff, General Marshall, there was consideration of moving all the ethnic Japanese, including citizens who were 80% of the Japanese ethnics on Hawaii, moving them to off-island to Molokai, which was a bizarre suggestion, and the Army itself nixed it because these people were needed, of course, for the labor force. They were 40% of the population. So instead, the Army, as you just said in your introduction, the Army introduced martial law within hours after Pearl Harbor attack. And took not only suspended civil liberties, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of all the procedural guarantees in trials, closed the courts, even closed the U.S. District Court to appeals under habeas corpus, where people who were arrested could obtain redress or at least a review of their case by a judge. It was remarkable. I mean, it had never been done on that scale in American history for except the shortest of periods of time, as in the Civil War.
The concern, of course, was sedition, right? That the local Japanese and Japanese American population would become a kind of fifth column, would communicate.
Yes, that was definitely the fear.
That was the fear. And it's my understanding that there was not a single instance of that during the war years. Is that right?
There wasn't a single instance by an ethnic Japanese, a Nikkei, as we say, whether citizen or alien, not a single instance. There was one instance of espionage, which was by a German-American who had, before the war, actually before Pearl Harbor, had actually reported to the Japanese consulate on the movement of American ships, a man named Otto Kuhn. But no Japanese-American was ever accused or found to, let alone found, have engaged in any hostile acts.
The concern always with history is that it tends to be repeated, as is well known. And we might think of that martial law that happened in Hawaii as an aberration. But I heard a proposal just a couple weeks ago from a presidential candidate of what he called preemptive enforcement in Muslim neighborhoods.
Right. Yes, this idea of preemptive detention was adhered to actually by the U.S. government and the FBI in particular. Mm-hmm. Drew up a list in Hawaii of 2,000 names of people who they regarded as security risks, and in fact, several hundred were picked up on December 7th and December 8th and incarcerated. The great majority were Japanese extraction.
In America between the world wars, there were a number of German-American Bunds, right? And there was a pretty wide base of popular support for what was going on in Germany,
right,
from as running as high as Charles Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy, our hero,
right,
openly supportive of the Nazi regime. And yet the Germans weren't as identifiable, right?
Yeah, well, they were identifiable insofar as they organized. And in these Bunds, they were very prominent. And then there were these outspoken supporters of Hitler and Mussolini. Actually, President Roosevelt was concerned about them as he was concerned about Japanese Americans. And the FBI was ordered, starting as early as 1938-39, to start compiling lists of people who were considered dangerous enough that they should be picked up in the event that the U.S. entered the war. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. There was concern in the 1930s that was sparked in that regard, but why was a little different because of the fact that it was a racial issue.
That's what I mean. It was a lot easier to tell who was Japanese than who was German.
Right, and that actually posed a problem for the Koreans who lived in Hawaii as well, because the army took the position they couldn't distinguish Koreans from Japanese, so they just brought them under the same constraints. And during the war, everyone was under constraints. I mean, there was telephones were censored, mail was censored, the press was under the thumb of the army. As I say, the courts were closed for time for any kind of civilian actions, and but everyone was under that constraint. So you have over 400,000 Americans, 85% of them citizens, and including 120,000 Japanese Americans who were under that kind of control. And one of the really big issues in this time was the control of labor. The army just took over control of labor.
Yeah.
And they made absenteeism a crime, so that you'd be brought before a military court called a provost court if you were absent from your job without the permission of the employer. That also became an issue for the employers exerting a lot of authority over their workers as a result. The labor unions went along with it they were weak to begin with, but they went along with it as a patriotic duty. But over time, by 1944, they were pushing back against this kind of control. But it was a comprehensive control over everybody in the islands. Every civilian was under this. The Japanese Americans were under greater constraints. They weren't allowed to have any evidence of Japanese paraphernalia and the like. And almost 2,000 of them were incarcerated. They were picked up and incarcerated. About 10,000 in all were investigated. 2,000 of them were actually either sent to the mainland to camps, or were near the end of the war actually put on Hanauiui, which is now, as you know, people in Hawaii are very proud of this. It's been named a national monument.
Harry, we have to go. Thank you very much for taking the time. You've uncovered a lot of valuable information in this book. I appreciate it. Harry N. Scheiber is the author, with Jane Scheiber, of Bayonets in Paradise, Martial Law in Hawaii During World War II, published by the University of Hawaii Press.